This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
So much about American life is going to change in a post-Roe world, and that includes the workplace. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, the 27th of June. Good to have you along. Disney, Dick's Sporting Goods, Meta, American Express, Goldman Sachs. These are among the latest in a growing list of companies that say they will cover expenses for employees who travel out of state to access abortion care. This after last week's Supreme Court ruling striking down federal abortion rights. In some ways, this may seem like a strange role for employers to play. The travel benefit, which is new for some companies, raises all kinds of questions about privacy, social and professional stigma, and legal liability. But in other ways, it's an old story. Employers have long been the primary provider of a lot of social supports in this country, from health care to retirement plans. From our workplace culture desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more.
There's really no precedent for an employer benefit that cuts this deep into bitter social divides. But the rationale for employers providing it isn't unique, says Hubert Joly, a professor at Harvard Business School and former CEO of Best Buy.
In the case of Roe versus Wade, this is not about getting on a crusade of, you know, which side is right or wrong. This is about the company saying, I have people in my care who are employees. And it's vital for us that we have a diverse workforce where women in particular are well represented and feel that they can be the best version of themselves.
Joly says it's fundamentally about the relationship with employees, current and future. The same reason an employer might provide any benefit, from weekly massages to paid time off. But providing benefits on a company-by-company basis means they're often distributed unequally, says Eileen Applebaum, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research.
Of course, we always welcome whatever deep-pocket employers can do for their employees. But we also know that the main beneficiaries are white-collar, higher-paid employees at these particular companies.
Take paid family and sick leave, what could be considered precursors for this abortion aid benefit, as workers will need to take time off to travel out of state. Federal data show nearly all top-paid private sector workers get paid sick time, while only a third of the lowest-paid workers do. Almost 40% of these top-paid workers have access to paid family leave. But for the lowest income, it's closer to 10%. And Black and Hispanic or Latino workers are less likely than white workers to have access to these benefits. Josephine Calipeni heads the nonprofit Family Values at Work.
The private market hasn't solved these economic inequity issues in decades. I mean, they just continue to create a middle class divide and continue to create a gender and racial wealth divide.
Calipeni says while large, profitable companies can often afford to be generous, almost half of private sector workers are employed by small businesses, not to mention the scores of part-time, seasonal, and contract or gig workers who don't qualify for benefits, even from giant employers like Amazon.
When I think about the workers we have to solve for, I think about, you know, myself and my family members who are Black, disabled, working caregivers. And if we don't solve this for that profile of people, we're going to get it wrong.
Employer benefits like paid family leave or the new travel reimbursements are unlikely to reach most of the people who seek abortion care, says Rachel Jones, a researcher at the Guttmacher Institute, a reproductive rights organization.
We know from the research that we've done that the majority of people getting abortions are poor, low-income.
She says three-quarters of them are near or below the federal poverty level. Stephanie Lorraine Pinheiro leads the Florida Access Network, which funds abortion care.
The average income of someone that we have supported in the past year is $11,000 a year. They work in industry that doesn't typically provide benefits to them.
At least one business, the women-led dating app Bumble, based in Texas, has pledged to fund aid organizations like Pinheiro's, which reach beyond their employee base. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a down day all around. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Later this week, we'll get a sense of how the Federal Reserve's efforts to curb inflation are going when we get the latest Personal Consumption Expenditures Price Index. It's not just the U.S. Fed raising interest rates to try to slow down price growth. The world's central bankers are in a race to cool spending without crashing their economies into recession. Over the weekend, the Bank for International Settlements, known as the Central Bank of Central Banks, met in Switzerland. Leaders warned that the Fed and its counterparts have a narrow path ahead to bring the global economy in for a soft landing. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
The central banks of the world talked about inflation when it started showing up as the economy rebounded last year. But it only got worse. So they've started hiking interest rates right and left, because they really mean it. They're gonna whip inflation now.
The central banks are somewhat in a state of panic.
That's Adam Posen at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
The banks have all agreed they're on team catch up. We all think we're behind the curve. They have to raise rates fast to keep inflation under control, not just to bring it down, but to keep it from accelerating.
In other words, to avoid a combination of inflation and stagnant economic growth, known as stagflation. That's why the Bank for International Settlements warned inflationary psychology could become entrenched and self-reinforcing. The key to success, says Ross Mayfield at Baird, may be sounding like you will succeed.
Their jawboning and their messaging is a huge part of the battle, managing inflation expectations in particular.
Mayfield says if the Fed, for instance, can convince investors, businesses, and consumers it's ready to get inflation under control, even if that means raising rates enough to cause a recession, that in itself could drive down inflation expectations and the risk of a recession. But all that requires credibility, says Douglas Holtz Aiken at the American Action Forum.
The Fed's problem is it had to admit that it got it wrong last year. They thought inflation would go away, publicly said it was transitory. Even when it was clear it was higher and more durable than they'd expected, they kept their foot on the gas.
And inflation got out of hand.
Now they have to flip 180 degrees and convince people that they're serious about controlling inflation and will finish the job and have the skills to do the job. I'd say the jury's out.
He's keeping an eye on the growth of home prices and rents as an early indicator of whether or not the Fed is getting it right. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
You Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky spoke to G7 leaders virtually today, saying he wants Russia's war against his country over by the end of this year and asking for more help to end the conflict. It's been 4 months since Russian troops first invaded Ukraine. Since then, Western countries have targeted Russian banks and businesses with sanctions, cut off Russia's access to its foreign reserves, and essentially unplugged the country from the global financial system. The point of all this, of course, was to apply enough economic pressure that Russia would be forced to end its war. And that obviously has not happened. Marketplace's Savannah Marr checks in on the state of the Russian economy.
World leaders didn't expect their blitz of sanctions to immediately halt Russia's war machine, says Chris Miller with Tufts University's Fletcher School.
They wanted to limit Russia's ability to fund its military over the medium term and limit its ability to acquire components for defense production.
And by those measures, he says the sanctions are having an impact.
The collapse in Russia's imports is beginning to be felt.
Miller says those imports are down by about half, which means product shortages for ordinary Russians and slowdowns in manufacturing.
The Russian firms are struggling to source some of the components that they need for production,
including production of weapons and military technology.
And this is just going to accelerate.
And then there's the news that Russia has defaulted on its foreign debt. Alina Rybakova, deputy chief economist at the Institute of International Finance, says this milestone is more symbolic than anything, in part because Russia doesn't have a lot of foreign debt.
It's like defaulting on $20, you know, that you owe a friend.
And because Russia has plenty of cash from its oil and gas sales to pay those debts. We just won't let them do it. Western countries have blocked Russia from using international payment networks.
You know, it's not a significant macroeconomic event by itself. What is significant is Russia's becoming a pariah state.
G7 countries are considering a price cap on Russian oil and planning to ban imports of Russian gold, which would reinforce this pariah status, says Tim Ash at Blue Bay Asset Management in London.
You know, the West will diversify aggressively away from Russian energy and commodities.
Ash says much of that diversification will be permanent. And that means
less investment, less growth, fewer jobs. I would think stagnation and decline is probably the outlook for Russia.
Ash says sanctions aren't likely to bring an end to the war anytime soon, but the damage to Russia's economy could be long-lasting. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
Coming up,
I need money I earn. I put in my piggy bank and never spend it.
It's never too early to start saving. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 62 points, 0.2%, to close at 31,438. The Nasdaq lost 83 points, 0.7%, to finish at 11,524. And the S&P 500 subtracted 11 points, 0.3%, and 3,900 points even. Savannah Marr told us about the state of the Russian economy. A related item, the Yale School of Management says more than 1,000 companies have now said they've curtailed operations in Russia, at least to some degree. The National Association of Realtors says the number of signed contracts on existing homes, that is pending home sales, rose slightly in May, 0.7%. That breaks a six-month skid. Still, pending home sales are down year over year in all regions of the country as mortgage rates rise. Speaking of that, bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.20%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. When was the last time you went to the mall? There are signs Americans are getting more comfortable shopping indoors again. In a new survey from Morning Consult, 73% of people said they're somewhat or very comfortable going shopping at a mall. Even before the pandemic accelerated the shift to more spending online, though, malls were in trouble as tastes changed and anchor department stores and other retailers went out of business. But design critic Alexandra Lang says don't count out the American mall just yet. She's author of the new book, Meet Me by the Fountain, an inside history of the mall, which starts with Victor Gruen and the first enclosed shopping center he designed in Edina, Minnesota, Southdale, which opened in 1956. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So it sounds like you grew up, as I did, a fan of the mall. But what made you want to write this book from a design criticism standpoint?
I really felt like the mall got a raw deal in terms of architecture criticism. But now the largest number of malls are about 30 years old, and that means that we have enough distance from them to see them as historical objects. And I thought, what if I write a history about them that combines an analysis of their architecture and kind of their role in building cities and suburbs with an analysis of the cultural impact that they have come to have? And people have really strong feelings about malls, and I feel like it's important to write about architecture that people have feelings about.
I was kind of surprised that a lot of the early malls were really ambitious architectural works. There was a focus on innovation and artwork and materials. But as you mentioned, they sort of quickly became the subject of derision by architecture critics and a lot of Americans, frankly. When did that change?
Well, I think in the first flush of mall buildings, say, you know, 1956 to the mid-1960s, a lot of the U.S.'s most ambitious architects were working on them. It was this brand new form, and they felt like they could really, you know, use their skills to shape it. But as malls became more popular and more began to be built, they were built in places that maybe didn't have the same income base, and so the developers didn't want to put as much money into the design. Architects also found out that, in fact, you didn't have the outside of the mall didn't have to look that nice for it to be popular. But most people's vision of the mall is of these blank boxes by the highway with a big department store logo on the side, and developers found that that was fine. People would still go to the mall if that's what it looked like. What they cared more about was what was happening on the inside.
The development of the mall, of course, intersects with all kinds of social and economic and racial history. And you describe how the suburban shopping mall was all about replicating the feel of downtowns without what many people found undesirable about urban environments, especially white people who are fleeing to the suburbs. How did the advent of the mall contribute to racial segregation and inequality?
Well, the mall was built to serve the families that were living in the new single-family home suburbs. And those suburbs, either de facto or by homeowners association, were for white families. There were very few suburbs to which Black, Asian, other people of color, in which they could buy homes. And having the mall meant that those people didn't have to go back to downtown to shop. They could live in this bubble world outside the city and not have to deal with things that they may have found distasteful, dirty, different about downtown.
So as I was reading this book, it kind of dawned on me, and I don't know why it took me this long to realize it. Of course, it makes sense that every decision that went into the design of malls was about maximizing sales, from the fountains to the artwork to the air conditioning. Can you talk about how malls were basically designed to keep people there, and even the stuff that wasn't on its face about shopping was about shopping?
Yeah. I mean, Southdale, in the original advertisements, they said 365 shopping days a year. You know, Southdale is in Minnesota. In the winter, people did not go downtown to shop. You know, there was cold winds, there was snow. So it was really sold as this way that store owners could keep shoppers, you know, kind of in their grasp all year round. And that's where we get a concept called the Gruen transfer, which, as I describe in the book, is that moment when your trip to the mall goes from being, you know, checking off your to-do list to being a pleasure in itself. It's things like plants and fountains and a nice food court where you can meet your friends. And so, of course, that means you stay at the mall longer, you make impulse purchases, you're kind of caught up in like the drama and scenography of the mall.
Fast forward to today. Obviously, the pandemic has not been kind to malls, which were already struggling from the shift to online shopping. But you think that we've exaggerated the death of the shopping mall. Why is that?
Well, everyone I talked to in retail said that the pandemic didn't change the trajectory of malls. It just accelerated the trajectory of malls. That they had already been going downhill in some cases, and the pandemic wasn't really changing the projections. But what I think has been over-exaggerated is that even if there is a mall die-off, which there definitely is, there are still going to be, you know, 700 to 800 healthy malls. And that's a lot of malls. So the rhetoric around the death of the mall, I feel like, gives people the idea that malls everywhere are just going to disappear, and they're not. The other thing I don't really love about the rhetoric around the death of the mall is that then I feel like once you consider something dead in our minds, it sort of goes away. But, you know, as an architecture critic and someone who's interested in urbanism, I actually want people to see malls as a place where we could do a lot of new and creative things in old cities. That this first generation of mall that was built, you know, 70s, 80s, and those are the ones that are more likely to be dead, they really offer an opportunity and a lot of open space that cities could rethink and build, you know, new kinds of community centers in.
All right. Alexandra Lang wrote the book Meet Me by the Fountain, An Inside History of the Mall. It's out now. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Cadillac is getting into the high-end electric vehicle market, and by high, I mean very, very high. The Wall Street Journal reports that the luxury division of General Motors plans to sell the limited edition Cadillac Celestiq, that's Celestiq with a Q, at a price of around $300,000. Yep, $300K for a car. We asked Marketplace's Matt Levin to find out who's actually going to buy that.
Cadillac plans to make fewer than 500 Celestiqs a year, according to the Journal. GM would not confirm those numbers or the price. So why are they doing this? Jessica Caldwell at the car shopping site Edmunds says it's an old-school marketing tactic, the halo effect.
It really is something that brings interest to your brand. People may want to go to a dealership to just check it out.
And maybe you drive away in the Cadillac Lyriq, the $60,000 all-electric SUV. It's all part of GM's attempt to change Cadillac's image from something grandpas drove in 1965 to something more 21st century.
This is giving Cadillac an opportunity to start again and try to rebrand themselves.
Cadillac has trailed European luxury brands like BMW and Mercedes, says Thomayi Sardari, a marketing professor at NYU.
The whole aesthetic that Cadillac has still been producing is a little bit too heavy, too American, and not as elegant and sophisticated as some of the European luxury brands.
Cadillac will be competing with their EVs and with Tesla, which dominates the market. But Sardari says the Tesla brand is a bit more vulnerable than it used to be.
This is always a danger in luxury. Neither the founder's personality nor any of the ambassador's bad behavior should tarnish the product.
Sardari says Elon Musk may be creating new Cadillac buyers. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Usually when we hear from experts on this show, people who study the inner workings of the economy, they're people of a certain age, as in adults. Today, we're turning the mic over to a different kind of expert, a 9-year-old, who gives us a glimpse into her own personal economy.
Hi, my name is Ellie, and I am from Novi, Michigan. I used to not like spending my money because I regretted spending my money on things. Once I went to the fair, and my mom let me play one game, and I got a toy, but I was super mad and sad because I don't like spending money. Yeah, the money would just be, like, gone. It's sometimes hard to earn. Any money I earn, I put in my piggy bank and never spend it until, like, birthdays and holidays and stuff. Yeah, I usually buy my sister's books at the book fair. And, like, you should spend your money wisely and, like, plan of what you want to buy so you can save up for it. But I've always not really wanted to spend my money that much. Thanks for listening.
You know the standard disclaimer, always consult your own financial advisor. Ellie's story comes to us from our podcast for kids about money. The show is Million Bazillion from Marketplace. This final note on the way out with a nod to one of Kai's favorite indicators, TSA throughput. That is the number of people passing through security checkpoints at U.S. airports. Hit the highest level yesterday since February 2020. More than 2,462,000 people on their way to somewhere. Still, that's almost 200,000 people shy of this time in 2019. All right, we gotta go, but here's your moment of economic context for this Monday. Mitchell told us earlier how central banks are trying to engineer that elusive soft landing by slowing but not squelching demand. One encouraging sign here in the U.S., today the Commerce Department said orders of durable goods, think cars and furniture and equipment, grew last month by a modest but better than expected 0.7%. Our daily production team includes Anais Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Nicholas Giong, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Amy Scott. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.